tell you what, I think maybe we can finish today, and if we do, what do you want to do? We want to do a test on Thursday, or you want to do it Monday? Monday? Monday. All right. Okay. There's one in every crowd.
Concerned about
was pretty high, and that would mean in that private money, that would be loaned at about 8%. Well, if you're investing in a stock market in a speculative way, you say, well, who cares that it costs me a lot of money to borrow this money if I'm going to make a lot of money on what it is I'm borrowing? So you don't worry about it too much. Well, banks begin to say, why don't we invest in purchase of other companies? So banks are buying companies, and they're buying it on margin, that kind of business. So October 1929, it's October 29th, 1929, what happens is the stock market begins to crash. And then people get panicky who bought stocks on margin on the stock market, and they try to sell, and the bottom's going to fall out. United States Steel is the first one that simply hits the skids. And then there's a chain reaction, and what happens is the chain reaction is going to bring the dislocations of the economy that were there that a lot of people didn't see and overlooked. It brings them to the surface, and the depression comes in its wake. There were huge inventories. So if you're a company and you're in a bind, you have huge inventory, the first thing you're going to do is try to sell off your inventory and get rid of the people that are making the inventory that you've got all stacked up and can't sell. So people begin to be laid off. The depression really hit in 1930. Stock market crashes in 29, then towards the end of 1930, it really hit. And by 1931, the thing is full bore, or that would be into the third year of Hoover's presidency. Third and fourth years are an absolute disaster. Now, the Great Depression, as it's called, what's interesting about it is that there's a paradox involved with it. And what the paradox is that there is acute poverty in about one-fourth of the American people, maybe even more than that, all the way to a third are going to be unemployed shortly. But what the paradox is here is acute poverty in a time of great plenty. Great plenty. A great poverty. Well, okay, so if that's the paradox, how does one explain it? What has happened? A sick economy. Now, there are various elements that we can analyze today and say, gee whiz, there was a sick economy, and here are some of the points. Well, I'll give them to you one after another. And most of these things I'm going to mention now escape the views of most people. They really weren't aware of what it was that they were into. One basic thing is that the American economy could outproduce its market. You see, that's the key thing. That's the indication of these huge inventories. Outproduce our market. And something else that was new, and certainly not new to your generation, is installment buying. You buy things on the cut. You don't pay cash for it. You put a little money down, you pay off in installments, and pay interest on the installment payments. That's brand new, basically, in the 1920s. Well, that's the only way to buy. Well, okay. That's what's happened, but that's brand new at this time. However, there's still a lot of people of my generation, or just a little bit older than mine, who won't buy anything unless they pay cash for it. No. You know any people like that? Yeah, okay. Yeah. Pay cash. Yeah. Clip your plastic. Deadly stuff. I've been corrupted too. But there still is some vestiges of this kind of course to take care. But it's new. Installment fine. Well, you can see what happens. if you're without a job and you're left holding your debt, how are you going to pay for the darn thing? Or whatever it is you bought. The second thing would be foreign markets are a big question in the 1920s. Oh, by the way, this is what a lot of historians consider to be one of the underlying causes bringing on World War II, high protective tariffs between the various countries. So with high protective tariffs, that means foreigners don't buy enough of American inventory or things that we produce. So we've got a glutted market. That problem. So that'd be the second thing. The third thing would be, as already indicated, really, is too much money is going into rent, is going into interest payment on borrowed money, is being paid out in royalties, that kind of thing, and not enough is being placed into the market itself or into the pockets of consumers to purchase goods that are produced, above all when you've got a glutted market. And that's the another one of the reasons. Then the other one is, and this I'm sure would be hard for you to understand or to relate to, that 60% of the American people lived on less than $2,000 a year. Now, how are you going to relate to $2,000? I mean, you people. I can relate to it yet. I think my first paycheck when I was a young preacher was something like not even $400 a month. And that's 42 years ago. I remember my dad earning $130 a month. And that was considered a pretty good middle class income. Six kids would be fine, just fine, during the whole depression. Well, 130, how much is that a year? It's about 2,000. Yeah, see. So that's kind of middle class. So you say 60% of families are under that. Okay. Now, another statistic that goes with that is only, 2.3% of the American people made 28% of the economy. So 2.5%, roughly, rounded off, had almost 30% of the economy. So you have few rich, and then this huge bulk of middle class and under middle class. So too many people are low income, and if too many people are low income, they don't have enough money to buy stuff that's in the glutted market. We outproduce our market. Great poverty, but great plenty. The paradox there. Then another thing would be is the cheap money policies earlier in the 20s encouraged speculation. So that speculation created great debt, as you see, for example, in the Florida land boom. So too much speculation. Then another thing is, another thing would be there were too many self-managed prices, control prices, that kind of thing. So equal pricing, meaning to say that people in a certain sector of the economy would somehow get together and collaborate on a set price, and it's a price then that's kind of artificially high because it's not the result of competition. I mean, if all you people make the same thing and get together to agree to set an artificially high price and I buy from you people, the price isn't really competitive. It's artificial, too high. So there was a lot of that kind of thing, too. Then something we mentioned, I think, twice already the last few times we met is the farm block. The blocks, I don't mean the cash crops, were really in a depression ever since the end of World War I. What happens in the 20s is you have the advent of a lot of new machinery and tractors and that kind of thing. So you're going to debt for that. Another thing is you don't need horses anymore, not as many horses. Well, to keep horses going as your engine of power, you've got to grow hay for them. Now you don't have to grow hay anymore, so what do? You plow up more land to put into products other than hay, which means you're simply flooding the market, and whatever it is you're producing is a cash crop, and the result of that is your price is too low. And you've had to buy all this machinery, and you probably don't make enough money on what you produce to pay off the machinery that you probably bought on installment with interest. So the farmer's really in a bind. So a lot of new land was plowed up for new uses with mechanization and all of that and tractors that weren't there. Another general thing in the 20s is as you Fordize the economy, Henry Fordize the economy more and more with assembly line processes and this kind of thing, man-hour production, what one person working per hour can produce simply is skyrocketing at a time when job opportunities in a general way are declining. So that's another thing that's happening. So the labor force really was static in the 20s. Well, now what happens is, after all this stuff comes together, is banks have got to pay up what it is they owe for having expanded. And for them to pay up, they've got to call in all the notes owed to them. So finally what happens is a lot of this money which had been put in the stock market simply isn't there anymore because the bottom has fallen out. And in a way, the economy is operating on $70 billion of nothing. So how are you going to pay the piper? And you've hired the money and you can't pay back. So what happens? Economy goes into a deep depression. Harding has often been accused, Hoover's often been accused of having created the depression, and he's kind of the devil symbol for the depression. I think he gets a bum rap. I don't know who you can blame or anybody you can blame. Nobody, I don't think. But you can be darn sure of it that the Democrats, every 2 and 4 years above all, are going to re-crucify Herbert Hoover. Sure. You want to go back to Hoover? Oh, no, we don't want to go back to Hoover. Let's stick with FDR or anybody who claims his mantle later on in the Democratic Party. That goes on pretty well all the way almost to LBJ. Richard Nixon, I think, is the one who finally put an end to that kind of rhetoric on the part of the Democratic Party. Well, anyhow, well, at that point, the Republicans are pulling a lot from the New Deal. You know, they've got to learn to live with it. But anyhow, Hoover, what's he going to do? Hoover, in his own right, I think is rather important because he tried to, and remember his conservative Republican ideology of the 20s, given that he still did try to use the government in a new kind of suggestive way. So he at least tried to use the government as a way of getting at the Depression. And in this sense, he made it easier for Franklin Roosevelt to come along with the New Deal. Because in a way, he's beginning to prepare the ground. So Hoover kind of gives the idea that maybe what we ought to do to some extent is use the government. Although he's so bound by his conservative ideology that whatever that means doesn't mean too much. In terms, above all, of what's going to happen when Franklin Roosevelt comes along. What's interesting, though, is that in the campaign, who cuts out Hoover for spending too much money? Franklin Roosevelt, see. But once he becomes president, gee whiz, hold on to your hat. You but I don't think Roosevelt knew what it was he was going to do. But the point being, he criticizes Hoover for spending too much money. Well, be that as it may. So what does he propose? One thing he did is propose relief for farmers. This is an old program. $500 million, $500 million, as a revolving fund for farmers to set up marketing co-ops. And what that idea would be, kind of where we started this quarter with the grain, same kind of an idea. Or the populace, their idea, that you sell your produce to your marketing co-op, and they're going to try to sell it on the market when the price is right, and then pay you, and hopefully that way, if the co-op holds it over a 12-month period, you can sell it at a time when the price is as high as it can possibly be, because you're controlling the flow of what it is you produce. That's the old... What was that idea? Was kind of down south with the populace. Can't forget it. We talked about it. Whatever they called it. You know, where the government was the storage place. You know what I'm talking about. Another thing they did is set up a tariff. I don't think it's necessarily good, but the government did it. Just smooth, S-M-O-O-T. Hawley, H-A-W-L-E-Y, the smooth Hawley tariff. And that sets tariffs at a point where it encourages Americans to buy American, see, rather than Americans buying foreign goods. Whether that's good or not, I don't know. One thing he did, which Roosevelt is going to take over, it's about the only thing Roosevelt's going to take over, and it's the first of the alphabet soup administration. Roosevelt's going to have all kinds of alphabet soup, bureaucracies, and the New Deal. This is the RFC, and what that stood for is Reconstruction Finance Corporation. And the RFC, what it did, and this is kind of interesting, is it would provide loans to financial houses like banks and corporations which were in danger of going belly up to stabilize them and keep them out of trouble. See, I think it's important that this was done, but what part of the economy is really happening? The financial and the corporate structure. See, notice, who doesn't it have anything to do with at the first level? People. Not people. Another thing he encouraged is conferences to get people who are in a certain sector of the economy to get together and hold conferences to encourage one another to hold the line. Keep hiring people. Don't lay people off. Hold the line. See, the basic notion being that the whole depression that's emerging is psychological, and all we've got to do is restore confidence, and everything's going to be okay. Kind of that approach. Now, notice, though, basically Hoover, conservative Republican, ideology of the 20s, refuses any federal relief whatsoever. No way. Relief, the notion is that relief should be in the hands of private institutions, state institutions, local institutions, charitable institutions of one kind or another. Federal government, absolutely not. Ideologically considered to be un-American, not part of their history. Okay. So after the Great Crash, 29, the line is held for about 6 months, but then they can't hold the line anymore, and that then is when the Depression begins to really get a hold.
There's no federal relief, limited to agents, to the farmers,
other than that $500 million revolving fund. That's all. We're thrown out a year later. And then they're out of money with that.
Okay, so there's your situation. You're in about 1930 now, towards the end of it. President Hoover, in the real sense, is the leader in the White House. He didn't give, and how could he, give the psychological confidence at that juncture? See, because now what he came to stand for are old business ideology of the 1920s, which had failed. And Hoover was the great engineer as Commerce Secretary throughout the 20s, who supposedly, as great engineer, was going to have what? Two cars in every garage. So the ideology of business conservatism had failed, and increasingly American people come to see it in terms of having failed. So everybody's looking to utopia, and Hoover's going to be the one to bring in this utopia. There is no utopia. You've got the Great Depression. So Hoover ideologically simply couldn't cope with it. In terms of his life, conservative business ideology, according to his life, I think he did the best that he could. Simply trapped, you know, by contemplation of your own navel. And, you know, it can't be any other way. I think we're all like that. You know, at a certain point we can't transcend ourselves. You know, you gotta try to before that's tough. Well, he couldn't. So old beliefs in the law of supply and demand, that's all you need to let that go. Everything will be fine. That isn't going to work anymore. So Hoover's frustrated, pretty much so. Now what's going to happen is he's got political ramifications. Now say you're a Democrat, and it's 1930. Obviously, you as a Democrat are looking forward to what, 1932? So in terms of legislation, you're not going to be too deep here. You say, let's just wait it out and wait for it for 1932. When there'll be a changing of the guard. So I think there are a lot of political ramifications to this whole thing. So there's a political stalemate in the House and the Senate both. Now Democrats, what they're going to do is propose programs which they know darn well Hoover's going to have to veto because of his ideology. So that makes the Democrats look good. Well, good political way to go. So things that they know Hoover's going to disapprove of, that they're going to pass. For example, Muscle Shoals. This dam on the Tennessee River in Alabama, Muscle Shoals, they propose money. Well, let's build a dam there. Of course, that's not going to come until you get CDA under who? The New Deal. Some years later. Well, they knew darn well that Hoover's going to veto that. Federal government building a dam? Oh, damn, no. They kind of that way. Of course not. So he vetoed it. They proposed $2 billion in federal relief, knowing darn well that he's going to veto that. So he vetoes that. They proposed that the federal government set up employment offices. What business does the government have? Setting up employment offices, is going to veto that, of course. So in a certain sense, in terms of the economic catastrophe and Hoover's own limited belief, ideologically, that isn't going to get to first base. But when all is said and done, in the framework of his ideology, he did the best he could and moved in new directions in terms of that. But oh my word, when you compare what he tried and what Roosevelt's going to bring off, you know, the contrast is so dramatic. Then there are some other things that come to a head here. 1932, a lot of veterans from World War I are out of work, but they have been promised a bonus, really an insurance policy, from the federal government after World War I that was supposed to mature in 1945. Well, they organized what is known as the Bonus Army of World War I vets. They want payment of their bonus early. So what they're going to do in 1932 is stage a march on Washington. That's a good old American tradition, petition and boot. My taxi saw Martin Luther King later on, march on Washington. World War I vets are going to stage the bonus march, and they come to Washington, and they set up their village on Anacostia Flats, along the Potomac River. There are all these veterans, and things go from bad to worse. Hoover's in the White House. He himself doesn't order it, but finally what happens? They order out the United States Army, and guess who leaves? Former West Point Commandant, son of a Civil War, Medal of Honor winner, himself later on a Medal of Honor winner, conquering the Japanese in the Pacific. Come on. Douglas MacArthur. Sure. MacArthur comes there with his troops, and guess who's the young officer under him? Future President of the United States. Who came to hate the guts of Douglas MacArthur, who worked with MacArthur in the Philippines, Eisenhower. Sure. But anyhow, MacArthur gives the order to use force of the United States Army to drive these commies out of there. See? Yeah. And MacArthur, who's really right-wing, he's one of my books. I've learned to repent. He was a great general, no doubt, but he was one of my heroes as a kid in World War II. I wasn't a kid, I should have known better. Already a teenager. Draftable age. Anyhow, one of my heroes. He thought he saved the country from the Bolsheviks in 1936. I mean, you talk about the sickness under death. Well, there it is. And the right-wing conservatives. But interesting. But you know, to scare a lot of people afraid that the country is simply gonna blow. Then another thing that bothered him is just before FDR comes is the Farm Holiday Association. This is in our area of the country here, Iowa, Midwestern area, Minnesota too, where farmers who are in deep trouble are having their mortgages foreclosed or threatened with foreclosure. So the farmers get together, Farm Holiday Association, and they consciously keep a lot of their produce off the market because the price isn't right. I was thinking about this morning. One of my earliest memories is I think I was about 4 years old, which would put me right here in 1932, is driving from Milwaukee to Chicago, and there was a huge milk truck which had been dumped over. Right? And I've always thought since, when I learned more about this, that was one of the results of the farm holiday, where you destroy milk to keep it off the market. But anyhow, what farmers would do then is, say, the sheriff would say, okay, so you're the farmer, I'm going to foreclose on your farm and leave it up for public sale. All you farmers, you make darn sure maybe you have pitchfork handy or whatever, none the sheriff. And one of you folks buys it at a real reasonable price. And, of course, I'm the sheriff and I know this, so I'm not going to... I want to save my hide, so we're going to sell it to you, and then you give it back to the farmer. That kind of pressure in the countryside. A lot of people were really afraid that we're going to have revolution. Of course, by hindsight, website. I don't really know whether that was so, but who knows what would have happened had there not been some addressing of the Great Depression in 32 when Roosevelt was elected. Don't know. But anyhow, that's the situation at the end of Hoover's presidency. The man who dominates the decade, that's the way it ends up. Then, of course, FDR is going to come in on his wheelchair pretty quick now. Ideologically trapped. He was flexible, very flexible. In fact, almost radical. You see what I'm saying? In terms of where things were at in the 20s as to what is admissible and not admissible. He was the use of the government. Yeah. So you can see what you mean by trapped by your own ideology. You don't have the imagination. Can't have the imagination to stretch beyond. You know, we're all like that. Some of us, by rare exception, can bust out of that kind of a mental mindset, but I don't think most of us can. So we get stuck with our dogmatisms, you know, and are ready to fall on our sword for them, which I think is stupid. I mean, the older I get. By the way,